This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas, the show where local voices tell the stories that keep the Central Coast connected. I'm David McAbee. On this week's show, Halloween's around the corner and things are getting spooky at the Slo Film Center. I talk with Sky McLennan about what's creeping onto the screen at the Palm just in time for Halloween. Then Father Ian's back with Playing with Food. This week he's going nuts for beans as he learns about legumes. And finally, I meet Melissa Beveridge of Woolly Bear Travels, whose animal paintings are making a difference one sanctuary at a time. From horror flicks to happy animals, it's all part of this week's Issues and Ideas on KCBX.
Hi, I'm Sky McLennan. I'm the executive director for the Slo Film Center at the Palm Theater and the San Luis Obispo International Film Festival.
Sky, thanks so much for hanging out with me here on Issues and Ideas. Why don't you give me a little bit of background on yourself?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I grew up in Templeton, at Templeton, California, up the grade from San Luis Obispo. And I grew up loving film. My dad was an actor, and so I kind of grew up in the industry. And I just loved film because it essentially to me was a portal to the world, especially being in a really small town like Templeton. It really gave me access to all these different ideas and perspectives and all these cool things. And then I studied film. I knew I wanted to be involved in film somehow. I studied film at San Francisco State University. And there I actually just started wanting to meet people and kind of network. And so I volunteered at film festivals as a way to kind of meet people. And I just fell in love with them. And I really loved the opportunity to be around kind of independent thinking and thought and this other part of the industry that I hadn't really been exposed to. And so I fell in love with film festivals. And then I moved to Australia because I have dual citizenship after I finished college. And there I also worked in film festivals and then really fell in love with production design, so building sets and props and stuff, and I was doing that there as well. And I worked probably the most at the Sydney Film Festival there, which is a huge festival. And then I moved back home, and I worked in the wine industry, but then I also worked at Sundance and Tribeca Film Festival. And then I met Wendy Edson, and she was running the festival for the last 17 years in Slo and was looking to transition out. And so, yeah, I took over, and I was like, how great is this? I can take everything I learned back to my hometown. And then, yeah, a year ago, we took over the Palm Theater as well. And so, yeah, we're doing it.
Yeah, you guys are definitely doing it. We were talking about this off air. Is when I moved back in January, the first thing that I noticed was the film society here exploded between the Slo Film Society, the Film Center, everything you guys are doing at the Palm, the Film Festival. It's definitely not the scene that I left, but it's so exciting to see a pulse to the film industry here.
Yeah. We're a small community, but I think we're all deeply passionate and there's some unity and collaboration that's happening, which is really exciting. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Now, with Dad being an actor, were you growing up on set? Were you seeing like behind the scenes? How did that work?
A little bit. Yeah. I mostly saw a lot of the dark side of the industry, especially in acting. My dad was, you know, what would consider a working actor back then, appearing regularly on like guest starring on TV shows. And he was in a few big TV shows. And then you would be lucky enough to get the chance to work on these big movies. And there really wasn't that many at the time. And then also you didn't have Netflix and all those kinds of things. So there just was less work and more competition. And we made the decision to live here 3.5 hours away. So my dad was driving to LA for auditions. Now you can just send a casting tape. So it's a very different world. But yeah, I think I saw a lot of that, the rejection that comes with it. A lot of the like less of the glitz and the glam, but I did get to go on set a few times. So
I find that really interesting. You say you saw the darker side of it, and yeah. still you dove in head first into the industry. I saw all the bad stuff, and I still want to bite.
Yeah, I just love it so much. I love world building, and mm-hmm. I think, yeah, I mean, he exposed me to so many incredible films, too, and, you know, it was something that we both, like, treasured and shared. And I also think, like I said, we lived out way out into the country in West Templeton. My dad still lives out there. And I was a very creative kid and had a big imagination. And yeah, I think film just kind of naturally fit with that. So.
And so you fall in love with film. Your dad's mm-hmm. busy working in the industry. And mm-hmm. you decide that you want to go to San Francisco and give this thing a try.
Yeah.
And how do we fall in love with film festivals?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I just knew. So I have this habit of moving to very small film communities. I think my dad also, knowing the experience he was having in LA, which was pretty brutal, and I won't say it, everyone in LA is like this, but just this kind of fakeness and just disingenuousness. And so I decided I didn't want to go. That wasn't where I was going to go, was to LA, which would have been the more logical place. And that's where people go to make movies and all that. But I took a different route. And in San Francisco, also a really small film community, there wasn't, and at the time my classes were getting impacted, I wasn't going to be able to get the kind of hands-on experience that I wanted. So I learned in that community and at school was like, if I want to make it here, like, in film, or I want to learn, I need to put myself out there. So that's when I started volunteering for the festival, because I just thought, well, if I start volunteering, I'll meet people that like film, and, you know, these things will kind of connect. But what happened there was, I think just what happens at a film festival is this really like kinetic energy. And there, it's not just like the filmmakers, but the people that are coming, I think is, and I was working in as a ticketing. And so I was having more interaction with the real people coming to experience these films. And that was what really excited me, was the exhibition piece, which like no one talks about, is, okay, you work really hard on this movie and everything, but who's going to watch it? Who's going to see it? How are they going to react? And there's just all these little moments that I started to really treasure, like talking to people in line about what they saw and how it brought up, triggered a memory from their childhood. Or
film festivals are such a unique opportunity because of, like you're saying, you're seeing films that are not yet released that sometimes may never be released. Mm-hmm. And if they do, it's probably years down the road. So it's a really unique opportunity to, you get to sit with the filmmakers, you get to sit with the cast, but also the audience is a unique perspective. It's not just a regular ticket holder going to the multiplex. They mm-hmm. know what they're getting into and they know what they're going to see, and it's usually something very unique.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and you bring up a great point, is a lot of times you don't ever see these films ever again. And yeah, I think it draws in, it's just off of the mainstream. And yeah, I have very like specific moments sometimes for some of these screenings and films that I've seen that aren't just tied to even the film itself, but just the memory of seeing it in that theater and that audience and experience. One just came up for me was the creator of the OA. She had this film called Another Earth, and it was about the idea of this, just they look in the sky and there's like another Earth just like ours in the sky. And like everyone's freaking out and they don't know what it means. And you never actually find out what's up there. Such an interesting sci-fi take.
First, I love that movie.
Yeah.
So it's a great example. And it's and those are the types of stories you may see at a film festival, especially like something at the Slow Film Fest, a little I don't want to say smaller, but a little more contained. You're going to find simpler stories wearing a big package.
Right, yeah.
And why today do you think film festivals are so important?
I think there are a lot of stories out there that never get the light of day through these mainstream channels. And film festivals, you know, we're we're basically like curators, you know, we're combing all these different films to present these films to, you know, our community. Our film festival is going to be different from another city's film festival. We really think about, you know, what are the things in San Luis Obispo County that people want to see, they want to talk about. You know, we partner with other a lot of other nonprofits and communities to use film to also not only bring awareness to the issue, but also like how can you create, bring it that impact locally. I think film festivals, the way the energy that they bring to films and connecting with the filmmakers and having them here in person and all those kinds of things, it's a very, I think people are craving that as opposed to just watching a film like they normally did. And that's why we're seeing kind of the decline in regular movie going.
Again, I said it before, you're getting a uniqueness and an authenticity from a lot of these festivals, and you're getting to experience something that you're not going to get on a streamer. It's not just a thumbnail that you're scrolling mindlessly by. There's something tangible to it.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. And I think, yeah, it has a lot to do with that Q&A or even just the kind of films that we choose. Like, we're trying to get things that we know are really going to make an impact on you, and you're going to leave the theater a little bit different.
So you go to San Francisco, you jump on a plane, you're living in Australia, you decide to move back to the States. And then how do you get involved in the film culture here in SLO?
Well, it had a lot to do with, thankfully having the opportunity to get involved with the film festival. And at that point, I had enough experience working at other festivals. And it is something that's like a very unique skill set that I have that not everyone has. And so Wendy was like, she's like, where did you, like, did you fall from the sky? Like it's kind of rare that I would just kind of come back into SLO. So that helped. But then I've also made, like, I made a conscious effort to get involved in the film community, to make friends, to be supportive of other people that are doing work here. So the Central Coast Film Society, we work a lot with them. And, you know, one of them's on our board. So that's kind of my philosophy has always been like a collaborative leader. I want to work with partners here in our community. So I do make a lot of outward effort to bring folks in, you know.
And how is SLO and the surrounding county reacting to you guys?
It's been super positive. I think that people are seeing it. Like, hearing you say that when I first came in, it means a lot to me because I've been working really hard on it and our team has been working really hard. But it's been positive. I think people feel energized by it. We're bringing in new audiences that we've never had before. You know, the festival was, and this is a problem for a lot of other festivals, is that it was predominantly like a white older audience. And so I've tried to bring folks in that maybe didn't feel that the festival spoke to them or there wasn't films they could relate to, and bringing in new genres. I mean, this last year we brought in a horror movie. We never done that. We do that at the theater, but we're not really in the festival. And that's a space I think is really, some exciting stuff's happening. And yeah, brought new folks in that normally would never come. So yeah, it was cool.
Good. We need to get people in those seats. As a lifelong horror fan and a horror filmmaker, we need more horror up on the screen. Less in real life and more on the screen.
Yeah. And I think people, it's funny because, you know, we're have like a stacked October calendar with horror, and I have a few people that are like, oh, it's just too much for me. Yeah, it's like, it's horrifying out in the world right now. I don't want to see it on the screen. But horror really is like our greatest fears, you know, being actualized. And they're really crazy, surreal, and I think philosophical things that you can explore with horror that are really exciting, and beyond just like blood and slashing and all of that, like there's more to it if you really examine it. So.
Yeah, if you're unwrapping the box of a good horror film, it's not just the slasher. It's way deeper than that. And it's usually a solid drama surrounded by horrific events, or even a solid comedy with horrific events surrounding it. And they give horror movies a chance.
And yeah, I'm sure you know of them, but Jason Kaiser and Katie Neville with Micro Horrors, they have a DIY horror film festival. And so, yeah, we've worked with them. They're going to help program some shorts for the festival this year. And they, they just like love horror and made this film festival, I think, going in its fifth year now. And it's five horror movies, 5 minutes or less. And it's just been a great way, I think, for the community to get involved. And all kinds of folks make films and submit them. So it's been really cool to see.
Are you seeing locals starting to make more films and submit?
Yes, definitely. So we have a Central Coast Filmmaker Showcase, and that's definitely grown. And not only that, but the talent and the level of skill is continues to rise. Like, we have a few people now, they've shot feature films, which is really exciting here locally. And yeah, it's really cool to see, and it's definitely growing. I think there's definitely been a lack of equipment and kind of the basic things that you would have in major cities that you do need. And now there are a couple of folks that have all that, so it's making it a little more accessible. And then people have phones now, and there's some really creative things being done with that as well. So there were some barriers to filmmaking, and we're seeing less and less of that now that it's, you know, more cost affordable and all that.
I've said it 1,000 times, but I grew up in the era of having to borrow a video camera that you would put on your shoulder to go make movies with your buddies.
Yeah.
And I've mentored other writers and other directors, and I've always said, we carry a 4K camera in our pocket literally every day. There's nothing stopping us from making something. Write a script, get your phone out, get your buddies together. At the very least, that's where you start, and then you go up from there. Tell me a little bit about the Slow Film Center.
Yeah, so I kind of had this idea percolating, and Jim D, who's the owner of the theater, Palm Theater, as well. And it is a similar concept to what a lot of other festivals are doing across the U.S. We all in our town have these like beloved theaters that are at risk because the film industry has changed just so dramatically. And the way of doing things is different, and we have to adapt. And so Jim came to us and was like, look, what my model, my for-profit model, doesn't work anymore. And I'd love for us to collaborate. And the festival is actually born and started at the Palm. So it was like kind of a natural fit. And kind of like that seed was planted. And I was like, oh my gosh, yes. Because for us too, as a film festival, we want to have a year-round presence. And so being able to have a physical space that we can offer that was really special. And so, yeah, it kind of came from there. And it's really cool. I think it's allowed us to have a lot of creative freedom and explore things we've never been able to. We're doing all kinds of events. We're really just trying to keep the theater alive for folks that love the Palm. And so really being as creative as possible. And so that's been really cool.
So the Slow Film Center is out of the Palm Theater?
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea, the name is like kind of confusing, but the Palm Theater, because we know people love and call it the Palm, but I want folks to think about that the Palm Theater is the center of film, is the Slow Film Center in our community. So you can expect all kinds of, we do a lot of repertory screenings. We do new independent films, which some people think that we don't anymore, but we do. Every week we have a new slate of films from the indie circuit. And then we do special events. We're renting it out as well. So all over the book.
And it being October, the spooky season.
Yeah.
We're entering the last week of October. Halloween is just around the corner. What can we expect from the Palm and the Slow Film Center?
Oh, gosh. We have some really fun stuff. We have House of Wax coming up in 3D, and that's going to be a lot of fun. And we also have Return of the Living Dead. And
one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Hands down, one of my favorites.
Scream as well, which is a classic. I think is such a fun movie. It I love Scream because Scream's for all the people that do love horror, because there's just so much insider jokes there. And
it's almost 2 hours of a meta inside joke.
Exactly. And it's a blast. One I'm really excited about that I haven't seen since I was 13 is The Cell with J-Lo. That film is so crazy and visually just very unique.
And
so,
highly underrated, in my opinion.
I agree,
that
too.
That movie is so wild, especially, I mean, it was made in the late 90s, early aughts, mm-hmm. somewhere. I want to say late 90s.
Yeah.
And it is visually stunning.
Yeah.
J-Lo, Vince Vaughn, go see that one. That one, I think, is so much better in the theater.
Yeah, it is. It's very unique. And I think, it was a little before its time.
Do you guys have any special events coming up?
Well, we are collaborating with the Central Coast Film Society for their Filmmaker Expo. And this is a great kind of ties to the community aspect of filmmaking. They're going to have they used to have it at the Clark Center. It's going to be at the theater, and there's going to be camera workshops and discussions and all kinds of cool stuff. And that's going to be in November. They just announced it. And that's the Central Coast Filmmaker Expo. So we're looking forward to that. We're also working with the YTT Northern Sumash Council on a special program for November for Native American Heritage Month. And so we have some speakers for that, and they were able to select some films. So
it's an exciting lineup, both for the end of October and moving into November, but it always seems like an exciting lineup every time I check it out. There's something for everybody, and there might be a movie or two that you've seen once or maybe never seen, but go get a ticket. Go sit your butt in that theater and go experience something new for a second.
I talk a lot about this. I think we're becoming less and less curious.
We've grown up in the last maybe 10 or 15 years where our algorithm is giving us everything that they think we like, instead of us trying something new and experiencing something that it's not being force-fed to us. And that's where it's fun. Go check out a movie where you've seen one preview or no previews. You like the title, you like the star, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Take the chance. And that's the fun part.
Yeah. Some of the conversations in the lobby after a film are my favorite thing about films. So, yeah.
Heck, that was half of my film school.
Yeah, right.
Were conversations like that. What did you think? I didn't like it. Well, I liked it. Well, here's why. Well, thank you so much for joining us here on Issues and Ideas. Where can people reach out?
Yeah, so you can find us either at the Palm Theater, TRE.com, or at slowfilmfest.org. We're also on Instagram, the Palm Theater, and Slow Film Fest.
Sky, thanks so much for joining us here on Issues and Ideas, and you're listening to KCBX.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food.
Beans, beans, the musical fruit. The more you eat, the more you toot. The more you toot, the better you feel. So let's have beans for every meal. Ate my beans and they were loaded. Went to bed and they exploded.
Beans. They come in so many varieties, and they are absolutely delicious. One local farmer grows many varieties of beans, the kind that you eat the pod and all, like green beans, the kind you have to soak overnight, like pinto beans, and another surprising variety whose identity I'll let unfold through this episode. Beans are in a category called legumes. You may have also heard the term pulses. Legume refers to the plant, pulses refers to the edible seed inside, whether eaten fresh with the pod, like sugar snap peas, or eaten without the pod, like dried beans. And today, we're going to look at three types of legumes, but only two are pulses. First, a little background on the farmer, and then off to the fresh beans first.
So my name is Ariella Gottschalk, and I am the owner of Halcyon Farms in Arroyo Grande.
Can I ask two questions, historical questions? Are you related to the Gottschalks of Santa Maria Town Center East?
No relation. I wish. I probably wouldn't be a farmer. I'd probably be vacationing in Tahiti right now if I was one of the members of that Gottschalk clan.
Okay. When I would come here with my dad, who lived in Santa Maria, for him to get his produce, it was not called Halcyon Farms.
Yes, so this farm used to be called the Routiz family farm. And about 3.5 years, actually almost 4 years ago now, my husband and I purchased that business from the Routiz family.
Well, congratulations. Were you farmers before that, or did you leave some high-powered jobs in Los Angeles to come do farming?
No, I was actually a farmer before this, but I was had a very sweet job. I worked for Transitions Mental Health Association. I was the program manager for Growing Grounds Farm in Santa Maria. And so I always like to say that I got to play being a farmer and get a salary at the same time. So I had the perfect training for being able to do this kind of job, but without any of the pain of crop failures, or, you know, I always got to get paid, so that was nice. And I've lived on this land above the farm now for 25 years. You know, I made friends with Jerry Rutiz, and, you know, he gave me lots of advice. And so over the years in that relationship, we were able to transition really easily into me taking over from him.
Okay, so what do we got here?
Okay, so these are our Blue Lake green beans right here. And they're looking really good. They're nice and dark green, long, straight. Just what you want in a green bean. Pick one. You can.
Can I just eat it right
here? Give
it a
taste. Yeah. And so those, I think they taste great raw.
Mmm. They do taste great raw.
Yeah.
Yeah. Straight from the field. How easy are these to grow?
Green beans are very easy to grow. You just put the seed in the ground and add water, and they hardly take any fertilizer. You don't see any white flowers here anymore. That's because all the flowers have turned into green beans. And so this is going to be quite a productive field of green beans. You know, we have three rows and we'll have like pounds and pounds and pounds of green beans.
Okay. And how long does this crop take to grow?
Green beans are pretty quick. They're like about 60 to 70 days, depending on the weather. Although they never seem to be ready when you want them to be ready, or they're ready before you want them to be ready. So it's just, you know, depends on how hot it is sometimes and how nicely the sun is shining or not shining. But generally, it's about 60 to 70 days.
Okay, do you have more than one crop?
Yes, we plant green beans every 6 to 8 weeks in the summertime. And then we try to have a crop for Thanksgiving because everybody wants green beans at Thanksgiving. And I always struggle with timing for that because inevitably the weather's going to be somewhat weird at the end of this, you know, this time of year. It could get cold, it can get really hot. Last year I planted them, I thought it was the perfect timing, and they were ready 3 days after Thanksgiving. So this year I planted them 10 days earlier, and they're going to be ready probably for Halloween. So it's just the timing. Hopefully you just keep planting them and you just kind of like eventually will have them all the time. That's okay, what our plan is, to have them all the time.
Like, yeah, you could just like one row a week. Plant one row.
Yeah, well, we do three or four, but yes. Yeah, no, not every week. That would be overwhelming, but every like I said, every 3 to 4 weeks is good, or 4 to 6 weeks.
You mentioned the weather, the hot and cold. What we didn't mention is that you're here in Halcyon.
Yep.
How many miles from the water?
I think it's for like a mile as the crow flies.
Okay. Probably. And it's October, so it's not fog season anymore. How does summer affect your crops? Because if you need sun, I know it's not as foggy, but you have June gloom. Like, how does that affect your green beans?
So you plant them and then you hope to have a steady supply. And that's why we plant several crops, why we keep planting them. You want to make sure that you continue to have them so that you can put them on the table for people, because it's summer and everybody expects to have green beans. Everybody wants their green beans for the summertime.
And then Thanksgiving.
It's like, why do they make green beans a Thanksgiving thing? So, yeah, I mean, weather is always a factor for us, for sure. But then, yes, green beans, because they like the heat, they can only be grown in the summertime. So we'll start them maybe March. We hope to have some sun, and we hope that they do well. And they usually get enough sun to produce. Like I said, they're not a real difficult crop. They're pretty tolerant. You know, if we're lucky, we'll have them for Christmas if the weather holds up. You know, if we have warm days, which we lately have had very warm winters.
Yeah.
We have these hoop houses over here. There's 6 big ones right here that we use for our early crops where it's warmer. The plastic kind of keeps it more of a warm temperature in there. And so that can help with some of our early season or late season issues. We do have a crop of green beans that we just planted in that last hoop house that will hopefully be good. Maybe those might be our Thanksgiving green beans, actually, come to think of it. Because everything's just growing so much faster than I expected it to right now. Last year was so much colder this time of year. So yeah, every year is different. One of the things that is great for us is we have so much diversity. So like, we don't have green beans, well, you know, have corn. There's always something that we have. So if the weather turns, we don't lose our shirts, so to speak.
How much water do they take? I noticed that you have overhead sprinklers for this.
Yeah.
So two questions. How much water does it take and why overhead and not drip?
Mostly for convenience. The way we grow our green beans is we plant them in the middle of these corn crops. You can see we have two crops of corn on either side that are planted at the same time. So we'll plant three rows of corn, three or four rows of green beans, and another three rows of corn. And putting the sprinkler in the middle, it's just the right amount of water to get the whole block that we planted together. We do use a lot of drip irrigation here for our crops, but these green beans are pretty quick. So to put a drip line in, you're basically putting out a big row of plastic. That's an expense, and it's not going to be here for that long. Yes, it's more efficient for watering, but then you have to throw it away at the end of the crop because inevitably it's going to get cut and the gophers will chew it. The green beans, because they're so closely planted together with the corn, I actually think that the sprinklers are very efficient because there's not a lot of open ground here. All that water is definitely going right to the crops. There's not a lot of space for weeds to come up.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm at Halcyon Farms in Arroyo Grande checking out legumes with Aurelia Gottschalk. Before we moved on from the fresh beans to the dried beans, I had a question about my favorite types of green beans. When and where is the best time to buy sugar snap peas and snow peas here on the Central Coast?
There's not a lot of snow peas being grown right now. Snap peas are like the big thing that's super popular, and of course shelling peas. Yes, early spring and winter is when we grow them here in our kind of coastal climate here. Mm-hmm. It used to be like in Santa Maria, those fields were loaded. I mean, that was like pea heaven. Everybody was growing snap peas. It was like big, big business. There's been some pests that have come into the area and in the soil that have started to affect vitality of the snap pea crops. And I think a lot of people have kind of given up on them. They just start getting rust and mildew, and it's just been challenging to grow them. We've had a lot of challenges growing them as well, but you know, they're super popular and they're, you know, everybody wants them, so we keep trying. But they're a lot of work. I mean, they're really tedious because they're vines, so you have to build a support for them. You got to put in stakes, and then you have to come around every 10 days to 2 weeks and string them because they don't grab onto the stakes by themselves. You have to build a trellis along the row as they're growing, and then you're waiting for them to flower, and then they make the pods, and then it's very tedious to harvest. At least you don't have to bend over to harvest them because they're up high. So each pod harvested by hand, it doesn't weigh very much. I think a lot of people would say that that wouldn't be their favorite crop to grow.
Right.
It's definitely not my favorite crop to grow, but I do love to eat them. So
yes,
we keep growing them.
I love eating them too. But now we're off to look at dried beans. When I did the episode on pinquito beans all those years ago, I didn't get to see the beans in the field. This was my opportunity to see the fascinating production of dried beans.
So these are a dried bean.
Oh, look at these.
Yeah, so these ones are drying. And I believe these are the pintos. Yeah.
Oh.
So these beans are dried. And obviously, these are the kind of beans you eat, pinto beans. We boil them up and we eat them. We let them dry on the vine or on the bush. These are bush beans, until the husks are brittle and dry. And then we'll thresh them and we bag them up and sell them as dried beans. This is also legume.
Okay, they're very pretty.
Yeah, aren't they pretty?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they are pinto beans. They're just a different type because they have less red and more white.
You know, I think that it's just because they are still curing here.
Okay.
These ones, let's see, these ones I think are Flor de Mayo. Oh no, these are peruano beans.
Ooh, I learned about those a couple years ago.
Yeah, these beans are really good.
They
love
are,
these beans.
And they cook very quickly.
Mm-hmm, they do. Well, you know, the thing with beans, almost all beans, when they're fresh, cook a lot faster than beans that have been sitting on in a bag on a grocery store shelf for a while. These ones are still, as you can see, the plants are still green, and some of the pods are still green, so they got a ways to go before they're ready to harvest.
How long of a crop are these beans?
To green pods, it's probably about 80 days, and then to the drying stage where we can actually harvest them as dried beans, it's probably another 20 to 30 days after that. It's a pretty long crop, 3 to 4 months, 4 months.
So for the dried beans, as an aside, when I did my pinquito bean episode, I found out that the dried beans don't taste good fresh. They only taste good after they've been dried. So I did learn that.
Yeah.
But I didn't go out into the field like this.
Uh-huh.
So for dried beans, you kind of like, you're doing something that you wouldn't think you would do in a normal garden because you're just letting it go way past and all the plant life has died. And then you harvest, right?
Yes. Well, yes. To a certain extent, the plant life has died. I mean, you still have the seeds.
Right.
Seeds are still viable.
Yeah.
They're still alive.
Can you harvest them when they're fresh and then dry them?
No. When they're fresh, let's see, like this one right here is still green.
Uh-huh.
And it, see how it's flat?
Yeah.
It hasn't formed a bean yet. I don't know what it would taste like if you tried to eat it. Probably very starchy, and but it's, you know, it's just it's a tiny little thing. It hasn't really formed any... anything. This one's starting to go. There are varieties of beans that are really good fresh. You know, you shell them, like cranberry beans. I don't know if you've heard of cranberry beans.
I've heard of them, but I've never had them.
There's definitely some varieties that are good, and these probably would be good fresh when they're fully formed, and then they don't take as long to cook.
Right.
They're actually considered quite a delicacy, but it's a lot easier for us to save these and sell them over a long period of time if we dry them. And they're not a variety that's known for using fresh.
When will these be available at the stand?
Probably this one will be soon, but there's a couple of crops that have already been harvested. So we have Flor de Mayo, Pinto, and Peruano. I think both of those are available right now.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian at Halcyon Farms in Arroyo Grande, learning lots about legumes with Aurelia Gottschalk. The next legume surprised me. We're standing in front of jicama, and I was interested in jicama because it's popular in California, particularly in Mexican dining, but, you know, nobody knows what it is,
yeah,
right? So that's right. Jicama is a legume. That crunchy, nutty, slightly sweet root vegetable is a legume, but you don't eat the pulses. This looks like lima beans.
Right. It's related to beans. It's a legume. These pods that you see on top of the jicama are the seeds that will be harvested for next year's planting. And you can see it has these little flowers that are purple and they look like pea flowers. That also indicates that it's a legume. So a legume is just a kind of plant. But this legume in particular is grown for its roots. The jicama is the root of the plant and it grows under the ground. And interestingly about jicama is everything on the jicama plant is poisonous, except for the root. So you don't want to eat the leaves, you don't want to eat the beans, you don't want to eat the flowers. In fact, I don't think I see any bees on these flowers at all. I'm not sure if it's poisonous for them, but I've almost never seen a bee come to the jicama flower. Oh, see, now there is a monarch butterfly on the jicama flower. There we go. Well, interesting. So monarchs actually are poisonous. They have that certain design that indicates to birds that they're poisonous, so the birds don't eat them. So I wonder if that has something to do with why they would like jicama flowers.
Maybe that's their bird kryptonite, is they're like, yes. I'm going to do jicama.
They found the one jicama patch in all of Slo County. Oh, you probably shouldn't put this on the air because this is not very scientific. You might have scientists calling up and saying, absolutely not, that is false data.
Well, I have a science degree, chemistry degree, so
okay,
I'll be the first one to say that's probably not right.
The root itself is very sweet. It's crunchy. When you pull it out of the ground, it's obviously dirty on the outside because it's grown in the dirt. You wash it off, you peel the outer layer of it, and then what's inside is like a white, crispy, kind of like apple-type flesh. It's very crunchy. It almost has an apple flavor, but it's not really that sweet. It's a unique flavor. A lot of people will put lime on it and some hot chili, tahine, something like that on there, and then eat it as like a snack food. I mean, I think it's great without anything on it. I just peel it and eat it. I think it's delicious. And it's very popular at our farm stand. People love it. This jicama that we dig the morning before we sell it is pretty much the best jicama you can get.
How do you harvest it?
You just dig it out of the ground with like a little shovel.
So these pods, it literally looks like lima beans on the outside.
Right. Well, that's a legume for you. It is. It's a bean plant, except for you don't eat these beans, you eat the root.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you know when it's ready?
When it starts flowering, then you know it's ready to start harvesting.
So this plant is the opposite of like every other plant on the planet, because when it starts flowering for other plants, that's the beginning of their growth.
Yes. So like a tomato, you need a flower that is pollinated by something from another tomato flower to make the fruit. But this isn't a fruit.
This is a root. So it's a little bit different. Potatoes are actually similar to jicama in that when you plant potatoes, they also make flowers. And that's how you know when you can start digging new potatoes is when you get flowers on the plant.
Okay. Okay. And so is this right? So we've got about 2.5 inches in diameter and about...
This is a little bit smaller than the normal jicama that we have for sale. But still... perfectly good. We generally have them a little bit, I would say 3 or 4 inches.
What made you decide to plant jicama?
Because of our foreman, Raul. He is our jicama guru. So Raul started growing jicama just as a little patch to have for his family. Being from Mexico, he learned as a kid how to grow it. And then he had a lot of extra. And we said, oh, well, let's sell it at the farm stand too, because people will like it. That small patch that Raul grew has now turned into 3,500 square feet of jicama. So that's why we grow jicama. This is not something that is in my wheelhouse of knowledge. Raul, he basically taught us how to do it.
Does it require any special skills that you did not have?
Well, not really. It's not a difficult plant. You know, you put the plugs in the ground, the little plants, you water them, you fertilize them, you watch them grow. There's a little bit of timing that's involved with it in terms of like when you plant in the season. It's a long crop. It takes 8 months or so to be able to get. Yeah, so these were planted early spring. You know, you have to be mindful about frost and cold and the amount of water that they're getting. But that's like any crop almost that we grow out here. So I wouldn't say there's anything real special about it. And once it gets going, it really is a great producer.
8 months is a long time, so I'm assuming that you only do one crop a year?
We only do one crop a year. Long crops like that can be difficult only because of weed competition, so there's a lot of weeding that happens in the jicama. We have to come through and weed probably 3 or 4 times over the course of the season just to keep the weed pressure down because it's here for such a long period of time.
And then do you, at the end of the season, just plow this under?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Hopefully we'll sell it all. It'll all be gone. And then we plow it under and we'll plant something different here next year. So we won't plant jicama in the same spot because it does take certain things out of the soil. Being a root crop, we want to grow something here that's not a root crop. Maybe some broccoli, lettuce, that kind of thing here. And then we'll bring the jicama back maybe in 3 or 4 years. It could come back to the same spot, but not for a while at least.
You mentioned there's 3,500 square feet. I don't know what that is in acres. And it's all going to be ready at the same time.
It's not all ready at the same time.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
It holds in the ground, which is one of the nice things about this crop is that, yeah, most of it's ready. Some of it will be bigger. You know, you can kind of feel underneath and feel, oh, this one feels nice and big. So we'll selectively harvest to a certain extent. It does hold for a period of time as long as it doesn't freeze, which we don't usually get freezes here for quite a while, if ever. So we can harvest it as we need it for the farm stand to sell.
Will all this jicama go through the farm stand, or do you have like restaurant customers as well?
Yeah, oh yeah, some restaurants buy from us for sure the jicama. Most of it will go direct to the customers through the farm stand.
What a day at the farm. I ate green beans in the field, I saw withering plants producing the dried beans I cook on a regular basis, and I learned something that I was completely unaware of, that the tasty root vegetable jicama is a legume. I wonder if the bean song applies to jicama, too.
To bed and they exploded.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
Hi, I'm Melissa Beveridge. I am the owner of Woolly Bear Travels. It's a company where I go to different animal sanctuaries and rescue organizations, and I meet new animal friends, and I learn their stories, and I take a lot of photos and videos, and then I come back to my studio and I paint them.
Thank you so much for being with us here on Issues and Ideas today. Why don't you give me a little info, a little history? Where did this all start?
Well, years ago, I went to a sloth sanctuary in Costa Rica, and I was working as a science illustrator at the time, and I was doing medical illustrations for the sanctuary, and I got the idea that I wished I could do something like that for a living, and I didn't know how to do that really. So I kind of came up with some ideas that didn't work out, and it kind of went on the back burner for a lot of years. And then one day I was here working at Animal Care Clinic, as a vet tech, and I was driving home from work, and I was on the 101 by Shell Beach, and I was living in Shell Beach at the time, and right at that spot where the highway stops every day with traffic, it stopped, and I stopped, and then a semi-truck behind me did not stop, and it slammed into me, and I was, like, spinning all around and hitting things, and one of my, like, I remember it all in slow motion, and one of my thoughts was I didn't get to do my animal project, and then when I wasn't dead, I decided I should go do it.
Well, I'm glad you're not dead.
Yes,
I'm glad
you too.
I'm glad. Let's just spoiler alert.
not dead.
It's so crazy that like life has to do that to us sometimes, to like shake us real hard to be like, hey, go do your thing.
Yeah,
you're just meant for this. Go do this.
Yeah, this is just weird. As I was like spinning towards like the semi itself, I was like, oh, I didn't get to do that.
Was it? It must have been scary and enlightening. Once the car stopped, I'm sure. Like,
yeah.
Okay. I'm alive. I'm still here. Time to get to work.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a little bit of a head injury that I had to work through. And then after that was settled, I got to go figure it out. So I've kind of been figuring it out since then.
Tell me a little bit more about that. How are you figuring it out? How did you figure it out?
Well, I was working online with a group that kind of taught you how to go out and do what you want, basically. And I had talked to them about it, and we were it was called Location Indie, and I don't know if they're still around, but it was just like taught you how to be location independent and travel around and make money and make a living and stuff. And I wasn't quite all the way with what they were teaching, but I wanted to learn how to like travel around and kind of get paid for it. So I looked into a lot of different classes and different things, and then I ended up at a conference that they had in Denver, and they were like, brought me up on the hot seat thing, and they were like, tell us what you want to do. And I told them, and they were like, tell us what you'd do if you had like all this money, how you'd do it. And then they were like, tell me what you would do. You know, first they were like, tell me what you do if you had all this money. And I told them, and they were like, what if you didn't have it? What can't you do? And I was like, a lot of it I could still do. So I was like, okay. So I ended up like going around and figuring out different things. I had a job that I was doing online at the time too. And I somehow, they were like, when do you want to leave? And I told them, and then I stuck to it. And they said, January. And I said, okay, yeah, I'll go in January. And then I went to the first place on my list was this donkey sanctuary in the UK, because I was watching their donkey cam all the time, and I love donkeys so much. So I thought I should start there. So I went there, and I stopped at a bunch of different places there. And, it all kind of started from there. Since then, in the ways I'm figuring it out, is I tried some different things, like working with wholesale, going to trade shows, to greeting card trade shows, stuff like that, because I make cards mainly. I do make other things, but cards are my big thing.
Let's go back a little bit. Where did this love of art come from?
I think it came from when I was little, I would enter these contests for FFA, and then we'd have to draw these like posters of animals and stuff. And I was not in FFA, but I don't know how I even got to do the contest, actually, now that I think about it. But my friend and I did it every year, and I kept winning, and so I was convinced that I must be good at it. I don't think I was. I don't know how I won, but I would enter little contests like that, and people would tell me that I'd win, and I'd be like, oh, maybe this is the thing I'm good at. So I kind of just started putting more effort towards that because I wanted to be good at something, I think. I started taking art classes in high school, and I just really liked it. So I just always, that was like kind of my thing that I thought I would be an artist or a veterinarian someday.
Well, that brings me to my next question. I mean, you've got a love for art and you've got a love for animals. Is the love for animals kind of maturing at the same time as your love for art?
I probably loved animals more than art always, but I didn't think I could go into like an animal profession because it seemed very difficult and sad, and I didn't think I could do it. But then when I was at that sloth sanctuary I mentioned, this clinical side of me came out that I didn't know was there. And I was like, oh, maybe maybe I could actually work in this field. And that happened to be right around the recession in 2010. So I actually was like, well, everybody stopped buying art. I was working as a science illustrator at the time, and everybody stopped buying art. And I was like, what can I do that will always have a job? And I knew it would be animals. So that's how that part came about. And eventually I just ended up finding a way to connect them both through the business that I'm doing now, because I get to go certain places, I get to go and help animals. During COVID, I got stuck in Africa for 6 months in Zimbabwe, and it was lovely. There was like nobody in the embassy or any, there was no way to really leave. And I was like, well, I guess I'll just stay here where I am helping animals, and I'll just keep doing that. So yeah, I just, in certain places and certain countries, I can do more than I can in others as a vet tech because of laws, how things are governed. So in Zimbabwe, I was like giving zebras enemas and, you know, taking care of baby baboons. And
just your run-of-the-mill regular Tuesday afternoon. Yeah.
So yeah, I just like to go and help if I can, and then, you know, try to help them with art afterwards.
Describe what you're, how you're helping with the art. I know that you give back to certain sanctuaries. Describe how that works.
Yeah, so I do portraits of the animals that I meet, and I put them on the cards. And then on the back of the cards, I will put the story about the animal, and I try to make it be a happier story of a better life, because there's enough sad things in the world to think about. We don't need any more. So I'll do that, and on the bottom I'll put the information of the sanctuary and how people can find them and donate to them directly. And then 10%, I keep track of every single thing I sell and have a ton of spreadsheets. And then at the end of the year, I will see how much I sold of a certain card and what sanctuary that benefited. And then I give back 10% of my sales to that sanctuary. And then I also help them, give them things to put in auctions and give them free stuff and try to help them with making people know about them.
And how do you reach out to the animal sanctuaries? Are they reaching out to you? Is it a little bit of both?
It's a little bit of both. It started with me just reaching out to people, and now it's getting to the point where people are reaching out to me, which is kind of fun. So yeah, at this point, it's about half and half, I'd say.
That's exciting. So people are reaching out to you for you to do what you love most, to hang out with the things you love most.
Yes.
Animals, and you're doing art.
Yes.
That's got to be so exciting.
It is exciting. It is.
Do you have any exciting stories of going to these sanctuaries and meeting great animals or painting an amazing portrait, meeting great people?
Yeah, well, the Zimbabwe was quite an experience, I have to say. I was just there to volunteer at a place for 2 weeks, and then the COVID hit and the border to South Africa shut, and I was right next to that border, and it was 6 hours north to get to the other northern border, and it was a military lockdown with basically kids with machine guns in the street. And like,
gosh, so wild.
A little crazy. I didn't really want to try to get 6 hours north, so I ended up staying. And then so for the first 3 months I was in the sanctuary that I went there to visit, which had a bunch of African animals that you would think of, like baboons and vervet monkeys and bush babies and mongoose and warthogs and zebras and just tons of different things. So I ended up taking care of them for the first 3 months. And then we were on a different property, which is a longer story, but these three donkeys ended up getting rescued. And as you know, they're my favorite. So I ended up going with the donkeys to a different rescue halfway through my time in Zimbabwe. And so then I was at a donkey sanctuary for the next 3 months, and that was just magical. The woman who owned it, I lived in her house. She had a restaurant too, and I rented a little art studio from her and took care of the donkeys every day. So that whole experience was great. One of my most favorite ones is last year I worked, this is so dreamy, I worked at this place called Oscar's Place. It's a donkey sanctuary up north. It's in Hopland, California. And they have, I think, over 200 donkeys right now. And they had me come up and meet their donkeys, and I painted 15 of them for them. And I'm like their sanctuary artist now, which is so exciting because it's donkeys. And it's like, it was just dreamy. I just loved it.
I love that But tell me, why donkeys? Where does this love for donkeys come from? Don't be wrong. I like them too. The big ears, they're kind of goofy. They sound weird. Why donkeys?
I think it's because I lived in Montana for a while. And I was working as a farmer at the time, and I lived in this little like sheep trailer on somebody's property, and this donkey named Dusty kept coming up to my little trailer, and he'd shove his nose through every morning, and he would like snort at me, and he'd try to eat the bread I'd have on the counter there. I just loved him so much. He was just such a nice little friend. I'd never met a donkey before, and I just like looked forward to seeing him every day. So that must be where it started, and I just kept just watching donkeys after that. And then when I'm around them, I just feel like so peaceful and calm, and it's a different feeling. It's their eyes are just so soulful and beautiful, and they're such kind animals. They're just lovely, and they just have so many bad things happen to them everywhere.
It's funny how we connect to certain types of animals. I'm a dog guy, and I look in my dog's eyes, and we can communicate. We can say whole sentences without even moving our lips or barking. Yes. Like we just know what's going on. And I think that's so special to connect with an animal on that level. And you're taking that and then you're portraying it into these lovely portraits. I mean, they're great. I wish this was a video so people could see. But where can people reach out and see some of your artwork?
I have a website called Woolly Bear Travels. It's Woolly Bear. It's a confusing one to spell. So it's woollybeartravels.com, and I have all my stuff there. I also have my art on a couple of utility boxes in town. So one of them is by Costco. The donkeys are on there. And then
I knew those donkeys looked familiar too. Yeah. I knew they did.
They're at Costco welcoming you in. And then there's some dogs and cats on one downtown on Higuera and Santa Rosa, some rescued dogs and cats from the county. And then I'll be at Slocally Made, which is a pop-up shop in San Luis behind Thrifty Beaches on the backside on Monterey on that side. So that opens on Black Friday and goes till Christmas Eve. And I'll have a booth there, which I have every year, and I have a ton of stuff in there. I also have my work in Los Alamos Gallery and in the Natural Toolbox in Pismo Outlets.
That's fantastic. You're everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere we turn.
Yay.
That's awesome. Tell me, where did the name Woolly Bear come from?
I grew up in Ohio, and there's these little fuzzy caterpillars that we called Woolly Bears. And everybody would collect them and kind of like stare at them. And there was even a woolly bear festival in town, and people would race their woolly bears. And like, it was just like I don't know. I thought everybody knew what a woolly bear was. Apparently nobody knows what a woolly bear is. And I just kind of wanted a name of an animal that didn't pigeonhole me into one kind of animal. And then somebody I was talking with suggested, you know, just kind of coming, like thinking of where I came from, and that I kind of was a caterpillar, woolly bear, and then I grew up into a butterfly and left and got to see the whole world.
I love that. It all rings so true. I like how your whole story has been one pivot after the next, from a semi rear-ending you, pivot into art, from being stuck in Zimbabwe, pivot, being in Montana, pivot, donkeys. It's pivot after pivot, and it's all led you to here.
Yeah.
That's got to feel exciting, because a lot of people feel that those pivots are stop signs or walls, and you've used those pivots to your advantage.
Yeah, no, I think I'm going to keep pivoting until I'm not here anymore.
Until there's no more pivots left.
Yeah.
Do you have any events coming up?
I'm doing the Wiggle Waggle at Woods Humane Society. It's this fun event on October 25th where they have a bunch of dogs that come in their costumes. There's costume contests and like ball pits for the dogs, and it's just a lot of fun. And then after that, I'm doing Paso Art in the Park.
Thank you so much for being with us on Issues and Ideas today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Our theme music comes from Gary Eister, and a big thank you to all of our guests and contributors. I'm David McAbee. Join me every Monday from 1 to 2 for more stories, more voices, and more of what makes our community tick. And if you miss something or just want to hear it again, you'll find every conversation waiting for you at kcbx.org. And remember, the best stories are right here at home. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. This is KCBX.